want to do is to just give you a little introduction to what genetics is. Try to tell you a few of the things that scientists are doing and some of the problems. There are a lot of really moral issues involved in science, and particularly in the field of genetics. I thought I could perhaps bring out some of these kinds of things too, but I would like to first give you a little background so you know really a little bit about what it's about. So I tell my students the field is changing very, very rapidly. Science in general, in other words, if one were to talk about science, our knowledge is doubling now in 10 years, meaning that in 10 years, half of what you know, you see, you only know half of what there is, and probably half of what you've learned is obsolete. Well, in biology, the doubling time for our knowledge is 5 years, meaning that we are doubling our knowledge now in 5 years. And genetics, which is the most rapidly moving phase of biology, the doubling time is 2 years. This means that a college student coming in as a freshman, yeah, by the time they graduate, the knowledge, you see, has quadrupled in just that 4-year span. So it's a fantastic change as far as genetics is concerned. I don't know if you're aware of this or have read any about it, but I would like to introduce you to some of the really important things that are going on. I really feel that everyone should have a basic knowledge of genetics. I really wish it were a simple course were required for everyone, because it's knowledge, I think, that does concern you and what's going on. Okay, basically, when you talk about genetics, we're talking about heredity, how characteristics and traits are transferred from one person to another. Now, this is something people have been interested in for years and years. In other words, even the ancients wondered about where we came from and so on, and the development of the child and so on, and even pedigrees of horses, and again, which would relate to genetics. Was rather interesting. There are a group of people very early that believed that that the sperm had within it a full developed person right within it, and so it was called theory of preformation. In other words, right inside the sperm was a whole completely formed individual. The only problem with that one was that when the baby was born, if it resembled the mother, you see, well, where did that come from? You see, the role of the female was merely just as a house for this little sperm to develop in, and then it would grow into the new individual. And then a group of people, probably the women's libbers, decided that it was the female egg, you see, that had the preformed individual in, and so I guess the argument went on. But it was later on, a man by the name, that they began to realize that it was both the male and the female together that was very important. And at this time, there was a belief that traits that you acquire could be inherited. In other words, the idea was the giraffe has a long neck because he stretches it, you see, and then his children will have a long neck because the father stretched his neck, and it keeps getting longer and longer. And therefore, if you do something, or in other words, if you are extra muscular, then that's immediately transferred to your children. Another little problem would be that if you missed an arm, supposing an arm were chopped off, you see, what about the effect of that, you see, on the child? Well, the answer would be that, well, the mother had a complete arm, so the child, you see, has a complete arm. And they actually believed that there were particles, you know, little particles for fingers and everything, and these all had to, you know, come together. And if you didn't have a hand, then there'd be no hand particles. See, but luckily the mother had a hand. But theoretically, now I don't know whether they came across this problem. What if both the mother and the father were missing a hand? Then what was the problem? So a man by the name of Weissman made a rather interesting experiment. He decided he would grow mice, and he would chop off the tail as soon as they were born. So in other words, there would be no little particles for a tail. And then he did this for 21 generations to be sure, absolutely sure, there'd be no particles for a tail. Well, then the 21st generation, he let the mouse grow. And the question would be, would it have a tail or would it not? And it did have a tail, showing that this inheritance of acquired characteristics was not valid. And so from then we moved on to some of our present knowledge. A good deal of what we're working with now is not how heredity occurs, but more or less why and what's really involved in it more deeply into the cell itself. And we're talking about such things as DNA. How many of you have heard of DNA? I guess just about everyone. I don't know how much you know about DNA, but I would like to tell you a bit about it. DNA is really the molecule of life. And if any of you heard the lecture, did any of you hear the lecture this morning about symmetry in nature? He talked about spirals. And he's rather of interest, this molecule of life, which is DNA. In other words, it's the important thing as far as life is concerned. It has all the information needed to make a complete you, a complete person. And this DNA is a spiral. And I've heard it say that all life is a spiral because it's so interrelated. In other words, the DNA is a spiral. And so many things have this spiral characteristic. And it must be an expression of this same kind of symmetry, which I think is really fascinating. But anyhow, DNA is a spiral. And it's the important thing as far as life is concerned. Okay, we are made up of thousands of cells. And here's a typical cell. And inside the cell is an area called the nucleus. Well, how big is a cell? How many of you have seen cells under the microscope? Yeah, a few I guess most of you have. Very easy to observe, I mean, just even with a cheap microscope or whatever. Just get a toothpick, scrape the inside of your cheek. You don't have to make it raw or anything. These cells are just lying loose, you know, just take a little bit from the inside of your cheek. Put some on a little microscope slide, add a drop of water, and you can put in some stain if you care to make it easier to see, and those are cells. They're your cells, and you will see inside that cell a nucleus. All right, now that nucleus that you see in that cell has all the information to make another complete person that is identical to you. In other words, all written in this nucleus is all the information to make your arms, your legs, and everything identical to what you are. So every cell in your body that has a nucleus has that written out information, so to speak. And what is the nucleus then? It's a region of the cell that contains the DNA. In other words, that DNA is so packed in that nucleus. In fact, that's another little problem we don't quite understand is how it gets packed in so well. Well, we've worked with virus, which are really minute, very, very small, and they've taken the DNA out of the little head of a virus, and it just strings out forever and ever and ever, and we wonder how it is packed in. And mathematically, they've figured out that it can be done, but there's no extra space for anything else. It is very, very packed in there. So in our nucleus, then, is this DNA, lots of it, that then is all that's necessary to make another complete individual. Well, of course, the question would be then, well, would it be possible to take a cell, take the nucleus of it, and grow another person just like you? And we would call this kind of thing cloning, C-L-O-N-I-N-G. Well, first the question was, we didn't really know that the nucleus did have all this information. We wondered whether it really did. So back in early 60s, and person worked with carrots. They decided that they would see whether they could make the nucleus, make a cell of a carrot, grow into a complete carrot. In other words, normally, you know the orange carrots that you eat. That's composed of cells. And what the question was, would it be possible to take a cell of that so that you would have one nucleus and grow it into a whole carrot plant to grow carrots? So how would you do it? First they figured, well, you would probably have to put that nucleus in the environment of a regular seed, you see, the environment of a fertilized egg. So what they did was to place it into coconut milk, which is pretty much approximates the environment of a scene. And they shook it up and they did this experiment, and they found that they began to grow multicellular structures, which eventually began to look like little embryos. And they continued growing these, and some of them began to get little stems on, and they planted these and actually grew carrot plants from a single cell, which demonstrated, at least as far as plants were concerned, yes, the nucleus does contain the information to grow a complete plant. The next thing was, what about animals? They tried it with animals for some time with no success, and so it was even suggested animals are different, the information is not in the nucleus, or you need more. But later on, it was in the late 60s, that they worked with a frog, and they used a cell from the intestines. You know, our whole body is made up of cells, so they took a little teeny cell from the intestines. It was comparable to the cheek lining cell, the same kind of cell. And the trick was, how do you get this now in the environment of the fertilized egg? So what they did was to take an egg from the frog, to remove the nucleus of it. I think they killed it using x-ray that was normally in there. And then they, with a micropipette, now this is not easy to do, but they placed the nucleus of this other cell, you see, into this egg, and then placed it into the frog so it would grow, and apparently they did succeed. No, I think they even did this outside, but they were able, through this, with just the, again, placed in the environment of a fertilized egg, were able to grow frogs identical to the one that they had taken the...
Well, where did they place the egg?
I'm not quite sure. I think they may have placed it into the female frog again, so again, it was in the right environment. So again, it demonstrated the fact that this nucleus now does have the information to make a complete individual, that it is all written there somehow on the DNA. The next question is, how is it written? In other words, how does this DNA possibly code for everything? Well, DNA, let me mention a little bit about it. DNA is a spiral, and it's two strands, something like this. And it's like a barbershop pole, you know, these two strands are each in a spiral and wrap around each other. And on the DNA are four compounds called bases, a possibility of four different bases. I'll just symbolize them by letters. A, T, C, G. These are the four bases, possibilities. Okay. We have a backbone bone here. The basic strand of your spiral is sugar and phosphate. And they're both the same, sugar, phosphate. All right, really the only thing that varies in the DNA are these four bases. And these project into the center. And they're bound together by a weak bond. Okay, if this is an A, this could be a C, a G, this could be a C, and so on. Once you have one strand with all, it's like a, you know, letters in a book or whatever, but once you have this one strand written out, so to speak, the other is predetermined, because A always has to bind with T, and C always has to bind with G. So I've got an A here, so what do we have to have over here? And a G?
C.
C?
G.
So those always pair together. All right, which means now if I pull this thing apart, one thing that living things have to be able to do is to reproduce. So you'll have to be able to divide the cell so that you end up with two equal cells. So this thing can divide by unzipping like a zipper right down the center, and each strand will build a new strand to go with it, and always it wind up the same as the original, because the A has to have a T opposite, the G has to have a C opposite, and so on. So in this manner, the two strands can separate, and you can synthesize then a strand to go with it, and you end up with two, whereas you start with one. Okay. The other important thing about the DNA is the symbols here, A, T, C, G. Now, why don't I straighten out a strand and do it something like this? Okay, this is important, this order of the bases on that long strand of DNA, because it's like a book. It tells the cell what to do. And it is this message that orders whether you have hands, arms, and so on. So this is a written out message, in a sense, that tells the cell what to produce. And it would be just like a book, and it would all be contained within the nucleus, all written out. All right, now how is it done? It's done in threes, generally. In other words, each one of the words is a three-letter word. And these words fit together to form what we call proteins. You've all heard of proteins. You should eat protein and so on. But the body then, it's very important that we make the right kinds of proteins and whatever. And so these things, this series of letters spells out proteins for the cell to produce. Alright, supposing we have a little mistake here. You've all typed a letter, haven't you, and made a couple of mistakes. Easy to do, even though you're copying off one you've already typed. Ah, let's make that an A instead of a G. What do you suppose is going to happen? Good probability that maybe it won't be so good, and you may end up with no protein at all. And maybe missing one protein might mean that you wouldn't be here at all. Or it might mean you have something like sickle cell anemia. Or maybe some other kind of thing like albinism. Or, you know, I'm sure you've heard of some of these kinds of diseases. Many times they're caused by just one mistake in this huge, huge whole line of DNA, rather of interest. So, and the more you study biology, in a sense, you marvel at the perfection. It would be impossible, to happen by chance. You just marvel at the amount of perfection involved, like in just the cell being able to copy itself with almost complete perfection. I mean, the length of the DNA to duplicate, you know, without making a mistake. I can't even write a sentence without five mistakes, you see, in typing it out. You see, and one typographical error could be fatal. There are checks and balances. A cell does have ways in which it can repair mistakes and so on. There are many little built-in things. So the whole subject in itself is really fascinating. But at any rate, so this then spells out a message, and it's really like a book in a sense. And the nucleus then is like the printing press, and it has all the information. And it prints out, so this is DNA, where all the basic information is. There's another molecule in the cell called RNA. It's very much like DNA. It is too a spiral. It's also a spiral, but it just has a single strand. And RNA is stamped out from DNA. And RNA would be the books, and the DNA would be the printing press. You see the RNA now, which is single-stranded, goes out into the outer portion of the nucleus, out into the cytoplasm, goes out here, and it does all the work. Then DNA just sits in here and reproduces itself in the form of RNA, where the work goes on out here. So this would be really how the cell functions, and a little bit about DNA. So the important thing about DNA is that you do have these bases, and the order of these bases is important, because it determines what proteins and all the substances that will be produced in the cell. All right, what would be the effects of perhaps x-ray or some of these kinds of things? We know that certain chemicals and otherwise affect the cell in various ways, and sometimes they affect DNA. And if they do, you see, it could have a hereditary effect. Radiation tends to break the chromosomes. I didn't mention chromosomes, but chromosomes are within the nucleus, and they're the bodies. They're rod-like, which are composed of the DNA. So the DNA would be within this rod-like structure called a chromosome. And we have a total of 46. And of your 46, you have 23 from your mother and 23 from your father, and these come together. So you have then a combination of characteristics from both your mother and your father. Okay, so these, what does X-ray do? It tends to break the chromosomes. Well, this can be not so good because when they break, then when the cell divides, you may lose a fragment or whatever. Or they may go back together again, which often happens, but they may go back together again wrong. And you may have various combinations that can be undesirable. Now, so X-ray commonly breaks the chromosomes in as little as 40 Rentgens. That's a very low dosage. Is all that's necessary to cause the rupture of a chromosome within a nucleus. Now, we consider as a lethal dose of radiation something around 250-300 Rentgens. Now, what I mean by a lethal dose is that half the people that have that dose will be dead within 30 days. Now, the effects of X-ray are not immediate. Usually they're slower, and so we say the lethal dose is then half the people will be dead within 30 days. It doesn't comment on the other half of people, what will happen to them. Some will survive, some not. So X radiation then, we consider that as a lethal dosage, but you see, it can have damaging effects on single cells or regions of cells. We have known a long time of the killing effect of X radiation on cells, and this is why they try using X radiation in cancer therapy. Now, cancer cells are cells that are dividing. When a cell is dividing, the chromosomes are out and they're exposed, so to speak, and they're more vulnerable to the X radiation at this time. So a dividing cell is more prone to damage than would be a non-dividing cell. And this is one reason why we use X radiation in cancer therapy, because in cancer, most of your cells are dividing, see. Now, the only problem is this. You can't be sure that you'll kill all the cancer cells. Rarely would you have 100% kill. Which means is all you need is one cancer cell left, because one becomes two, two becomes four, four becomes eight becomes 16, 16, 32, and so on. So maybe you could kill all but one cancer cell, but if you've got one left, probably in a period, depends on how rapidly your cells are dividing, but in a period of 1 year, year and a half or so, those cells will begin to catch up with you again. And another problem with the cancer is that it begins to, the tumor begins to break and spread through all the body. There's another problem with X radiation therapy. You can't be sure that the normal cells would also be damaged, and X-ray radiation has been known to cause cancer, which is an abnormality of the DNA itself. So these are some problems with X radiation. Ultraviolet can also be harmful. It causes faulty pairing in the DNA. In other words, A doesn't pair with T, instead T may pair with T. And you may change your C to something else. So these are problems with ultraviolet radiation, so too much of that can also be harmful. And we know that you can use ultraviolet radiation for killing bacteria. Very definite effects of killing with ultraviolet. So these can also be damaging. Of course, then there are many chemicals, these mutagens and so on, are chemicals that alter the DNA. And cancer, in a sense, what is cancer? It is an alteration of the DNA. And it is hereditary, you see. So if you have one cancer cell, it will pass it on to the second. So it is an alteration of the DNA itself. Now, what can cause that? It could be smoking, perhaps, that caused an abnormal environment, the mutagens that would cause a mutation. And various chemicals could cause it, or other, perhaps, unknown factors. It's been hypothesized that a virus could be involved, and maybe I'll tell a bit about how a virus could be, some of the work that we're doing with virus, and how perhaps a virus could cause a cancer and the relationship here. Back about, let's see, in the late 60s and early 70s, they discovered how to replicate DNA. And what I mean here is that the cell, of course, has been doing it since there have been living things, but we have not been able to do it outside the cell. But it is now possible to take a segment of DNA and outside the cell to replicate, what I mean is reproduce that same segment of DNA. Now you can see the implications of this would be that supposing now a person did have cancer, and if you knew what the faulty portion of DNA was, maybe you could form another DNA that's the right and somehow inject it into that cell. Or another example could be, suppose you have a person that's an albino, and we know pretty much what's the problem there. It's the failure to produce a certain enzyme that makes them the pigmentation, and so they have no pigmentation at all. So would it be possible then to make the right segment of DNA that you want that does program the production of the pigment, somehow get it into the cells, and then the cells would begin to produce, you see, this particular pigment. Now, this is the kind of things that geneticists are working on today. They're trying to replicate given segments of DNA. All right. Now, they're working largely with bacteria and virus. Most of the work in genetics is with bacteria and virus, but there is certainly an element of danger. And so the geneticists themselves within the past 2 years have gotten together and discussed some of the things that they're working with, and realizing the element of danger involved, I have placed moratoriums on certain kinds of research. And I don't know if you're aware of what is going on, but there is definitely an element of danger in what's being done, because how many of you read the Andromeda strain or heard about it? But at any rate, that was this new strain of something or other. Well, what the problem is, they're working with a bacteria known as E. coli. Now, E. coli is present in your digestive tract, and would be one that you see could be harbored by a human. Now, supposing they develop an E. coli by using this unique combinations of DNA and develop an E. coli that is carrying some very bad, you know, toxic substance, then that if developed, you see, if it entered into a human, you would develop some fatal disease, you see, that we would not be able to control. See, these are the problems. So in working with E. coli, we must be very careful that we're working with a strain that could not grow in nature, that would only grow in the laboratory. Because there are these, the possibility of producing an Andromeda strain of either a bacteria or a virus. All right, now the next question is, supposing you do have this little right segment of DNA that you like, and if somebody is an albino, how are you going to get it inside them? That's another little trick. I mean, you can't do it with surgery, and you can't eat it, which brings another fact into mind. Planaria. Now, how many of you know what planaria are? They're little teeny worms. They're about so big. They're called flatworms. They're really cute. I'll draw a picture of them. And you can find them in a stream. They look something like that. And there was a Dutch artist. He did a lot of prints, and he made it was rather interesting. He made his rather quite famous and rather contemporary, he made a print with a whole bunch of planaria, you know, all around. I thought it was sort of interesting that he used a biological thing, you know, for his prints. But anyway, those are planaria, or flatworms. These flatworms are rather interesting because you can train them. Not fair, I mean, they don't have much of a brain, but you can train them to do certain things. And usually you train them to reject a light or to go towards a light. And if they don't, then you shock them and you give them a bad time so that they do what you want them to do. Well, anyway, so you can train planaria. The interesting thing is, they're cannibals, incidentally. They'll eat each other. And you can chop up a trained planaria, and it will. And if you feed it to an untrained planaria, the untrained one will become trained without your having to train him. In other words, he can eat up a trained one and then acquire characteristics of that. Well, that sounds really great, you see. Because then, you know, what about the cannibals, you know, living in Africa or whatever? Maybe they've had something there. They would eat, you see, and then gain characteristics of whatever, whoever they ate. Well, what about us? You think that works? No, it would not. Now, we can eat horse meat or whatever, and you don't gain characteristics of horse or cow, and all of us start mooing and so on. And even if you ate some of Einstein, it wouldn't help you at all. Reason being, we've got a different kind of digestive system. Purely the planaria incorporates that DNA right into the cells, but we don't. It's all digested, you know, and one protein or another, what's the difference? And so it would be all digested. Well, how about injecting it? Any suggestions on that? Why not?
I think our learning takes is a chemical reaction in our own brain, isn't it? That, well,
yeah, well, it's believed to be related to RNA. Now, could we inject the right kind of DNA or RNA? What would happen? What happens when you try to make grafts, these transplants?
Rejected.
Yeah, it's rejected. We do not tolerate anyone else's DNA. So we would reject it. So that won't work either. So in bacteria, another interesting thing happens. In bacteria, you can place them in a brew of DNA, and they will actually take that DNA up through their cell walls and become changed because of that. Oh, which would be nice. Wouldn't it be nice if you lay in a bathtub of some DNA from Einstein and just seep up knowledge? But it doesn't work that way. So that's another problem. We don't take up the DNA. Bacteria do, but we do not. So we've got to figure out a way of how are we going to get this right DNA into the cell. Any suggestions?
Virus?
Yeah. And this is the most potential way. A virus. Let me tell you now what a virus is, and you can see how a virus can get that DNA inside you. A virus is a very, very small kind of structure. Now, I'm not going to call it necessarily living. Whether it's living or not determined on what your definition of living is. But a virus is nothing but I'm going to simplify this a bit, no? A protein coat has a little outside shell, and inside this is coiled up just completely full of, usually, DNA. Can sometimes be RNA, but it's usually DNA. But at any rate, in other words, hereditary information is inside that little protein coat. Well, how big is a virus? How many of you know how big a bacteria is? They're pretty small, too. But you can see a bacteria under the microscope. If you've got some you can see at 100 power. Most of them you probably need 500 or more. So a bacteria now is really small, but they can be seen if you have a good microscope. Okay, here's a bacteria, and this is the shape of good old E. coli, you know, that's in our intestinal tract. And you've got thousands and billions of them. In fact, you've got bacteria all over in your mouth and on your skin and your hair and just about everywhere, hundreds of them. And they are good to have. You don't want to get rid of all of them, because if you do, then something else will come along that you just as soon not have. The ones that, when you're feeling healthy, the ones that you have are
they live there and they enjoy it and they don't bother you. And some cases they may even help you, and there they are. But if you remove them, that leaves empty space for something else to come along, which might not be so good. This often happens if somebody's taking antibiotics for a long period of time. Antibiotics normally kill bacteria. So if you take a lot of antibiotics, you wipe out all the bacteria in your intestinal tract. And then what hops along may be a yeast, which is very difficult to get rid of. Why does it come? Well, it's always there to an extent, but normally your own bacteria crowd it out. There's no room for it to grow. But once you remove everything, then the yeast can start it, and then you've got real problems. Well, anyway, back to our bacteria. That's the size of a normal bacteria, maybe. I mean, I'm blowing it up, obviously. But how big is the virus in comparison? It is about like that in comparison.
Can you make it a little bigger? I can't see it.
Well, it's very, very small. And it would look like this, but it's very, very tiny. I may have exaggerated being a little small, but just to give you a relationship, how tiny that virus is. And so within the virus is this information, DNA. Okay, when a virus infects a cell, what it does is to land on the outside of the cell, and it injects that DNA into the cell. So the only change that occurs from a virus infection is that DNA has entered the cell. Well, you've all had colds and whatever, you know, virus infections. And it's all just because of that DNA that it can be disruptive. Now, in bacteria, when virus enter bacteria, frequently what happens is that the changes occur within the bacteria itself. Okay, this is the DNA from the virus, okay? But I'll make it big so you all can see it. The protein coat just sits on the outside and just drops off at the end of it. The virus itself, you know, the important thing now is inside the bacteria. What does that DNA do? It has information on it that causes the regular bacteria here to stop doing anything for itself. And what it does then is go to work for the virus. And it produces then some 200 little bits of virus DNA. So all the energy of the bacteria goes into producing virus DNA. What happens, it also assembles then little coats. And in the course of a short time, like 20 or 30 minutes, you may have 200 virus in there, all ready to come out and infect another cell. So that's pretty good reproduction rate, 200 in half an hour. Bacteria double in 20 minutes, which isn't bad at that, but virus are really very rough. Okay, so what happens? The cell ruptures and out come the little virus. Ready to infect another cell. Now this is called a virulent infection. And it could be likened perhaps until if you would have a virulent virus infection, you would know it. And it usually comes on fairly rapidly. I'm sure some of you have had colds that you feel all right at one time and then fairly rapidly, bingo, you have a nice cold brewing. And generally your bacterial infection would be slower. Okay, now what next? There's another kind of virus infection, and this is the one that relates to what we've been talking about, how we're going to get that DNA into the cell, because this isn't any good. That's just going to rupture your cell, and that's not going to work. There's another kind of virus infection. This is called a temperate one. And this time, I'll just use a bacteria cell again. The DNA enters again, but it does something different. This circle here represents the DNA of the bacteria. There's something wrong with this DNA. It's missing a little gene or something. A gene is a characteristic or an ability that it cannot cause the bacteria to reproduce itself. Maybe something that doesn't cause this continued replication, who knows what. But at any rate, instead of doing what happens in the virulent one, in other words, instead of reproducing itself, it becomes inserted right into the host. And there it is. Okay, well, what happens now? Maybe nothing that you can visibly see in the bacteria, but maybe so. You've all heard of scarlet fever. Scarlet fever is caused by the same bacteria that causes
strep sore throat. You've all heard of strep sore throat. Sometimes that strep bacteria has inside it a little virus. And if it does, you get scarlet fever. Because that little bit of segment, additional segment, causes the toxin that then gives you scarlet fever. So in that instance, this little temperate virus is not so good. Incidentally, diphtheria is the same kind of thing caused by that. Okay, so a temperate virus, it could be possible now. We don't really know entirely everything there is to know about cancer, but it has been suggested that cancer may be a temperate virus. And it may alter the cell such that instead of doing what it should do, it just continues to reproduce itself. Seems very highly likely. Now, could be that maybe you were exposed to a measles virus and you never got measles. That virus just attached to the nucleus, which later could become a cancer. These are suggestions that have been made. We don't know all there is certainly to know, but it has been suggested that a temperate virus could be a cause of cancer. Other causes would be anything that alters somehow that DNA. All right, now the next question is, how could a virus be helpful to us? Would it be possible to get a virus that has the right information in that DNA to somehow get that virus to infect the cell, inject the right DNA in, which would then become incorporated into the nucleus, and then you'd get your production of melanin or whatever? So these are things that scientists are toying with. What about producing a virus with genes for intelligence or whatever? Much less likely, because these are there are many, many genes, of course, involved in various kinds of creativity and such. But potentially there could be possibilities for we call this genetic surgery, for curing certain kinds of conditions by means of a virus. However, you can see how risky it might be, because who knows what that virus might do, and who's going to be the first volunteer? You know, are you going to volunteer for a virus for certain kinds of conditions, and so on? These are
Can the DNA RNA be altered by chemical means?
Yes, DNA can be altered by certain chemicals, definitely, and these are called mutagens. LSD would be one. There are many kind of chemicals. Some of those that were used in chemical warfare are definitely mutagenic. They will alter DNA.
What happens in some of our drug therapies, like what's going on with in psychiatry? They're using, you know, a lot of things, niacinamide, these things.
I don't think we really know many of these kinds of things. That's why I'm all of the theory of take as few kinds of drugs as possible. We don't know really what the effects are. Maybe not on you, but your children. The same thing with a thalidomide, you see, you remember.
Right.
And that was taken at a time, you see, the cells of the fetus are very, very vulnerable. One mistake within the first or second month could mean a whole arm or a whole leg. One cell would develop into a whole arm or whole leg. And so one error in that one cell would mean no arm or no leg. And this is what happened in thalidomide. It probably altered only maybe two or three cells, but at the point when that cell determined a major portion of the body.
Isn't it far before that rule?
Pardon?
Doesn't it happen
before? Yeah, probably before that, but it could have, I think the real danger was really in the first month that when they took the thalidomide. And again, radiation for a woman pregnant in the very early stages can be very, very severe or serious because, again, for that same reason, if you destroy just one cell, it could be a very important cell that could determine a larger region. Are there any questions that you have had on any kind of aspect or kinds of things scientists are doing or some of this kind of research?
I don't have any question on the scientists, but I work with premature babies, and I have one friend who had a hydrocephalic child, and they've been told told that they should go to a genetic counselor. Can it be determined, you know, if their genes are such that they could have children that would be deformed?
What the genetic counselor generally does, first they try to look back into your history, ancestors, to see if there's any history of such a thing. They'll probably take a chromosome count to look at your chromosomes to see if there's anything that looks abnormal. Now, or something like mongolism, yes, you can tell by looking at the chromosomes. But so many of these other things, you can't tell by looking at chromosomes because you see it's such a small segment inside the chromosome that there's no way of visibly seeing this. And then the only thing you can do is to check out ancestors and try to figure out relationships here. Many diseases, we just don't know if they are hereditary or not. It could be different kinds of causes. It could be hereditary, could be environmental.
You were saying that about x-ray. Then people who work with x-ray technicians, and that you could sort of think that they could have problems. You know,
yeah.
But they don't.
Many don't.
You know, it's been studied that they really don't have that much problem.
But I think they are protecting fairly well these days. Now, they didn't before, and when I look back at my history, because when I was working for a PhD, I worked with an x-ray machine, and I think back now with horror, because I don't really know, and we didn't know at that time the danger of x-ray, you know, it was just a little x-ray machine. I'm sure the thing leaked. And I wonder now, geez, you know, that I didn't apparently, you know, that I could have had a certain amount of damage to that. I think back now, looking at that, and I would certainly have, if I had known what I do now, I would certainly have stayed away from the thing completely. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, they were protective covering, but at the same time, don't they also have a tag where they have how many days they have been working with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so that is also kept track?
I think what they also should do, or at least what they're doing nowadays, is to have a little film with a paper clip on, mm-hmm. and to determine just how much exposure you are getting. And this is another way of mm-hmm. telling how much exposure. Mm-hmm. Now, we're all exposed to X radiation or a certain kind of radiation exposure just through the ground. And that's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
It's best to avoid as much other as possible. I'm sure we can tolerate, there is a certain amount of repair, and we can tolerate a certain amount, providing it doesn't come too fast. But there is always that element of danger.
Where I'm a little bit confused is when you talk about a cell, in our body we have so many different types of cells.
Right.
All right, now one cell reproduces that same type of cell, doesn't it?
Right, uh-huh.
So,
your question is, with the same nucleus, why do you have a muscle cell one time, and why do you have a blood cell, or why do you have an epithelial cell? Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
And they all have the same information, the same nucleus. Mm-hmm. That's a good question, which I didn't bring up. Which is very important in early development, because theoretically, if every cell were identical, you start out with a single egg cell, don't you? And if every cell were identical, why don't we turn into a mass of slime mold? We saw that yesterday, and it's nothing but oozing protoplasm all the same. Why aren't we nothing more than a slime mold or an amoeba? Because theoretically every cell would be mm-hmm. identical, but we're not. We've got head, arms, and we have, we use the term differentiated. Why? Because if every nucleus is the same, does every cell turn out differently? The answer to this is environment. There are two factors involved in development. One is heredity, which is the DNA, and the other is the environment. Now, you often hear about an argument about, well, what's intelligence? Is it heredity or is it environment? And then on goes the argument. There is no way of divorcing the two. Without the both, you don't have anything. You can have all the heredity in the world, but if you didn't have an environment appropriate, you're nothing. And you can have all the environment in the world, but if you don't have the heredity, again, you're... So the two work together, and they're very, very important. And they work together just from the very early stages of the egg itself. And so the egg itself is not homogeneous. And so you have this egg, and parts of it have more of one and more of another. So the environment of the egg is different. And so when you have two cells, those two cells are different. And four cells, they're all different. And so gradually you have this development process because of environment. And so what it is, in a sense, it's like having a cookbook. The nucleus itself is a cookbook, all right, has all the recipes you want. But it's the environment or you who deciding, well, today let's have popovers and let's have some roast beef and let's have some string beans. So you look up only those certain things. You don't decide, well, you don't throw all the ingredients in the whole book together and brew it up. That would be a horrible mess. You pick and choose certain things, and so the cell does the same thing, and it's the environment that triggers what's to be picked and chosen. And so you do have then this process. But if you were to take that muscle cell and put it in a different environment, then so it is the environment that determines what the cell will do in a sense. Are there any other kinds of questions? I think it's approaching 12.
Yeah, do you know anything about vitamin B17 for the treatment of cancer and stuff?
Not too much, no. I just know that we have been trying many, many different things, and some work and some... I think perhaps one problem is not all cancers are the same. They probably are different causes and could be genetically different, and what may work with some people may not work with others.
Well, where do you find vitamin B17? Is that in diet or not?
I'm not sure. I think you probably have to research it out and find out what particular foods it might be in or what kinds of... most of them can be made artificially too.
I know that in some, I don't even know what country it is, but it's found in their diet that they eat, you know, every day, and they don't have any cancer there.
Hmm. What country is that?
I don't know, I can't remember.
Hmm. No, I don't know,
it's illegal to buy it, and buy it here, but you can get it in Mexico.
No, I don't know.
It's only available, Leopold, it's only available for research in the United States. It is otherwise an illegal chemical.
What do you think people are doing to themselves by taking vitamins?
Well, pros and cons. I'm really not up on vitamin therapy. I'm more of the theory that try to get as many vitamins as you can out of the food you eat. In other words, eat good kinds of foods. But I realize today this is hard because you have to pay a lot more to get foods that are not extracted of all sorts of good things, like you have to go scrounging for whole wheat flour and wheat germ and the good things and bran and good kinds of foods. And it's so easy in the supermarket to buy things that have been, you know, nutritionally leached. I see no objection to taking a vitamin day, particularly with an iron supplement, because I don't think that our diet really supplies sufficient iron. But I'm not one who goes for taking heavy, high dosages of certain things. Unless, presumably, if you do have a doctor's prescription who does feel that maybe you do have a deficiency or your body is incapable of assimilating certain kinds of vitamins, that could be another kind of thing. But I don't sort of approve of you on your own deciding, well, I think I'll take 5 vitamins a day just because it might make me feel better. Because there can be harm in doing that. Vitamin A and vitamin A particularly does store within the body. Now the B's in and out, and no big problem. But vitamin A and some others become stored within the liver, and can be harmful if you really take too many. So vitamin D also. So I don't really. If you're under a doctor's prescription, fine. But just on your own to decide you're going to dose up on a load of vitamins, I don't really approve of this.
What about muscular dystrophy? Is that quite related to?
Yeah, this is a hereditary, and as I remember, I think it is sex-linked, meaning that it occurs much more frequently in males. In other words, in a sex-linked kind of condition, the male and female differ in the sense that the male has one chromosome and the female has 2. And so the male needs only one chromosome with this particular characteristic, the female would have to have the 2 before she would express it. So chances are the female could get a bad one, but the other one probably would be good. And so, but the male, you see one bad one and that's it. So for the female to have it, she would have to have a father who had it, which would be impossible, plus a mother who was caring.
I have one question, if I'm not interrupting. And it has to do with, there's been an awful lot of to doing about atomic power plants, and I think we've had some discussions here about it. And that's about background radiation. I know too, the increase in background radiation has been relatively minor, and I think that's kind of been taken care of. But when damage to the facility occurs, and then you get some radiation leakage, which has happened in the past, then the question arises: okay, what are the long-term effects of that type of a problem, genetically, which is we're speaking?
Well, depends again on how much leakage there is, but apparently it could cause an increase in our overall occurrence of leukemia seems to be related, and certain other genetic defects seem to be related to that. But you have to balance the pros and the cons. You have to balance, well, what about fossil fuels, and do we have these, and what are we going to do? I think we have to, there is there's no route that we can go without its kind of dangers involved. And even driving from where we live to LA on the freeway is probably more dangerous than a lot of other things.
Sure, I kind of recognize that, but I guess it's a knowledge. What we need, I guess, is the knowledge of what the potential impact is of such things.
Statistically, and I think there probably are some statistics all on. I know there are some. What the present has been in our gradual increase may have statistically on how many extra per million cases of leukemia. And I think it's in that realm, like 3 extra cases of leukemia per million people, and maybe 3 extra other genetic things.
If leukemia could conceivably become a major problem, it is a problem today. We really don't seem to have much to counter it from what I've been able to see. So we can expect some activity in that area to counter that problem, because we may even have an even greater increase.
It has been increasing, or else our knowledge of it, or maybe a lot of cases and we didn't detect in the past. Yeah. It's been with us for a long time. I remember reading that. It's been around, apparently occurred way back in early history, and they didn't know what it was, but it had been described in some early cases. But I think it probably is increasing.
Is it a genetic problem, and is it possible to counter it with genetic?
Well, this is what we're working with. Perhaps I think leukemia is one of the things that they will be working with, potentially a kind of virus that could cure it. As I feel, this is probably one of our best bets, although maybe it may be far off, but attacking cancer, and leukemia is a kind of cancer with some kind of virus. Bone marrow. Here it would be easier to place, because you could perhaps attack at the bone marrow site, because it's a faulty development of your cells.
I've heard, and I haven't read a lot of scientific stuff about this, but you know what myelomeningocele children are? Myelomeningocele children?
No.
They're children that are born with a spine open at the bottom, or wherever along the spinal column.
Uh-huh.
And the increase of this type of abnormality is really, increasing. And it's increasing in certain certain areas in the world. Around Regina, where I lived, there was a lot. In Virginia, in the States, there's a lot. And in Ireland, there is a lot. And these are the three main places in the world where they have a lot of these children. I don't mean a horrendous amount, but
statistically high enough so that you can notice the difference.
Right.
What do you call it?
Myelomeningocele children.
I think I've worked with a couple of them.
Yeah. And I was wondering, Barbara, if this would be totally environmental, atmosphere type of thing, or would it be a combination of X-ray from environmental? What do you feel that some of these things?
That's really interesting. I think what they need, I'm not sure what could be involved, but it would be certainly worth investigating. History of mothers before giving birth, what kinds of things, and the area itself, would there be more background exposure there? I don't
even the water and the minerals.
Yeah, innumerable kind of things that would
have to be investigated. I really wish.
But if you do have a localizing effect, it does highly suggest something environmental more than just straight genetics, because genetically it should be across.
I read that about MS that tends to be higher in northern areas.
Sure. Oh, wait. Well, real slow.
But supper, lunch is ready.
Are you ready for that?